Welcome back to Maryland Morning on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. On July 4th, 1861, just 4 months after President Lincoln was inaugurated, just 3 months after the first action of the Civil War at Fort Sumter in South Carolina, the president sent a message to Congress. He walked through his version of what had happened in the previous few months. Quote, "So viewing the issue," Lincoln wrote, quote, "no choice was left but to call out the war power of the government, and so to resist force employed for its destruction by force for its preservation," end quote. Afterward, Congress voted to increase funding and troops for the war by 25%. Adam Goodhart is a Washington College historian and author of 1861, The Civil War Awakening. When we spoke in the spring of 2011, I asked him to set the scene of the first summer of Lincoln's presidency.
Talking about people's expectations of Lincoln at the beginning of the Civil War, at the beginning of his presidency, I think it wouldn't be an exaggeration to say that they were very, very low. Lincoln had come from greater obscurity to the presidency than really any man who had ever assumed that office before. He was a one-term congressman from Illinois, really a failed congressman from Illinois. And he hadn't even set foot in Washington, D.C. in 12 years when he got to the White House. So people didn't know what to expect. He stepped into a federal government that then, as now, or perhaps even more than now, was dominated very much by a coterie of insiders, of party insiders, of congressional insiders. And here was this outsider, and he was a bit sort of physically and personally awkward. And it's interesting, after the war, his own secretaries, John Hay and John Nicolay, who were great admirers of Lincoln, said that no one at that time thought that Mr. Lincoln would be the chief man of his own administration, and least of all, Mr. Lincoln himself.
Oh, really?
That's right.
He himself didn't view himself that way.
That's right. Yeah, it's clear to us when we look back at him, and that's one of the things that interests me about looking at this moment in history, the very beginning of the Civil War, is that Lincoln is not the sort of great, omnipotent, all-knowing leader that we think of today. He was somebody who was really sort of bumbling and stumbling his way through the early weeks and months of the secession crisis.
And he really hadn't campaigned. It was unseemly for
the
candidate to campaign or to vote for himself, you write. And then even as the secession started, he didn't make it clear what his vision was. And after the surrender of Fort Sumter on April 13, 1861, and then the Pratt Street riot in Baltimore a week later, what was Lincoln spending his time on? What was the president doing?
Well, you know, everybody, of course, for one thing, from the moment that Lincoln was nominated the year before, everybody had been waiting for Lincoln's sort of great statement on this crisis. First, the crisis that was hanging over everyone's heads, and then the crisis that very quickly became reality at the end of 1860 as these southern states one by one seceded. And he had said very little. He came to Washington. He gave his first inaugural address that was, although we think of it today as a very eloquent document, there are some beautiful passages in it. In fact, the mystic chords of memory, the better angels of our nature. We think of it as this eloquent document, but it actually was very confusing at the time. It said different things to different constituencies and was very unclear to most people. So after the surrender of Fort Sumter, after the beginning of hostilities of the Civil War, Lincoln still hadn't made his sort of great statement as to what this cause was that he was asking the North to fight for. But he began working on this statement very, very quickly after the surrender of Sumter at the end of April and mid to late April of 1861. And he spent really the next 2 months laboring over this document that he intended to present to Congress on July 4th, 1861. He had called a special emergency session of Congress for July 4th. And by mid-June, he was working just about full time on this document. People were very puzzled. Even those who knew Lincoln well thought it was very strange that with a war quickly unfolding in America, the president should be holed up writing draft after draft after draft of this document.
And why do you think he did?
Well, I think that Lincoln understood at that moment that in writing this document, this message to Congress, he was really doing essential intellectual work, the essential intellectual work of the war in a way that was going to prepare him and prepare the country to fight. You know, even today, we have a hard time, and historians argue about the causes of the Civil War, about what the North was really fighting for. And I think that Lincoln recognized at the time that that cause might be hard to articulate, and he decided to sit down and articulate it to make it perfectly clear to himself and to other Americans what it was that they were going to war for.
That's Adam Goodhart, journalist and historian, here on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, 1861, The Civil War Awakening, specifically the last chapter, Lincoln's Independence Day Message to Congress. In some ways, you write, this presages the Gettysburg Address.
It does. There's, you know, this message to Congress, this July 4th, 1861 message, is not typically read as one of Lincoln's great masterpieces. But I think while the prose is not always as soaring as in his inaugural addresses, as in the Gettysburg Address, that intellectually, this is one of Lincoln's greatest, perhaps even his greatest achievement. He even uses in it, you can feel that sort of the rough draft of the Gettysburg Address in some ways. He talks about the Civil War, and he says, this issue, meaning the war, embraces more than the fate of these United States. It presents to the whole family of man the question whether a constitutional republic or a democracy, a government of the people, by the same people, can or cannot maintain its territorial integrity. And so here we have an echo or a foreshadowing of this government of the people, by the people, for the people. He's working those ideas out, and he's really arrived there more than 2 years earlier. He's recognized that this war is not simply about keeping certain parts of America, certain states within the Union. It's about whether democracy can even work in practice, or really as a theory. He recognizes, and he explains to his fellow Americans, that in a very real way, secession is the same as anarchy.
Yeah, he says, you say, that he says the very existence of the Southern Confederacy was not only a threat, but a crime.
Exactly. It's a crime because when you think about democracy, the idea of majority rule and minority concession to that rule are at the very root of what democracy is. And if you have a situation where people who are outvoted simply say, well, in that case, we're going to withdraw from the compact, go off and do our own thing, I think it's easy to understand why you would have anarchy very, very quickly. If you're ever in a situation where people who don't like the rules can simply withdraw, you have anarchy. It's sort of the same as if, I get pulled over speeding, the officer says you were doing 75 in a 55 mile an hour zone, and I say to him, well, I think that the speed limit should be 75, and so I'm going to just keep driving and rip up this ticket and throw it out the window. It's sort of the same abrogation of a social contract by denying governmental authority, and Lincoln recognized that.
The editors of the Baltimore Sun, which you describe then as, quote, unbending in its defense of slaveholder rights, close quote, they took issue with one paragraph in particular, and let me ask you to read the first sentence of that.
Sure. This is essentially a people's contest. On the one side of the Union, it is a struggle for maintaining in the world that form and substance of government whose leading object is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, to clear the paths of laudable pursuit for all, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. Yielding to partial and temporary departures from necessity, this is the leading object of the government for whose existence we contend.
The Baltimore Sun said he's clearly calling for abolition, but abolitionists said he didn't talk enough about slavery.
Exactly. You know, it's more than 6,000 words, this message to Congress of 1861. So it's about 20 times as long, 20 or 30 times as long as the Gettysburg Address, a very long document. But he doesn't even mention the word slavery once. He doesn't mention the issue of slavery once. He's talking entirely about secession in sort of the abstract, rebellion in the abstract, freedom in the abstract. But here he says something that's thoroughly new in American political life when he says that the object of government is to elevate the condition of men, to lift artificial weights from all shoulders, and then finally, especially, to afford all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. There he's saying something new. He's not simply saying all men are created equal. He's saying that government has to play a role in maintaining some of that spirit of equality. He's saying that government has to make sure that there are not artificial constraints that are placed upon each of us. And especially that last phrase rankled on many people reading between the lines when he says that government has to afford to all an unfettered start and a fair chance in the race of life. It's that phrase is interesting in so many ways. One thing that struck me reading it is when he talks about the race of life, he's using the language of Charles Darwin. He's using the language of this new theory of evolution that has all these different species and creatures competing against one another, jockeying for a position in the world. But he also uses this term, an unfettered start. And actually, when you think about it, unfettered start is a little bit of an odd metaphor. Going back and looking at Lincoln's rough draft, he originally said an even start in the race of life, which makes more sense from the point of language. People in a race get an even start, but then he changed it to unfettered, which suggests that he's thinking on some level about slavery. And interestingly, it was his opponents, his critics, who picked up on that very quickly in 1861, and those of his supporters who were more pro-abolition, like Frederick Douglass, for instance, didn't pick up on that and were disappointed at the message.
Adam Goodhart. He's director of the C.V. Starr Center for the Study of the American Experience at Washington College in Chestertown. His book is 1861, The Civil War Awakening. We have a link to a transcript of Lincoln's speech at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Also, a link to Goodhart's cover essay in April's National Geographic, tracing the route of Abraham Lincoln's funeral train from Washington to Baltimore and on to Lincoln's home in Springfield, Illinois. You're listening to Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast.